It had taken Robert Lemoyne barely 20 minutes to execute the man-in-the-middle attack. He'd first sighted Mira when she turned off the highway onto the gravel access road and stashed her bike in the patch of scrub, and had gone at once to his controls. By the time she reached the second gate, he had forced a connection with her phone, accessed her identifying information, obtained her stored encryption key, simulated her over-the-air transmissions, established a connection with the local mast, and then authenticated himself so that from that point forward, he could appear to Mira's service provider as Mira's phone, and to Mira's phone as her service provider. Not only did he now have complete access to her data, both present and historic, he also had the power to intercept and change her messages in both directions. Now, if he wanted, he could both alter what communication she received and send messages to anyone as her. It was a flawless capture. Had she ventured a little further up the gravel road, she would have come upon the trailer-mounted mobile cell site fitted with an IMSI catcher device that he had used to carry out the operation. Had she taken her phone out of her pocket, she might have noticed that it was hotter than usual and less responsive, and that the battery was draining fast. And had she looked directly overhead at any time while she was exploring the farm, she might have seen, high above her, the dark blur of a surveillance drone hovering in place. Of course, she'd done none of these things. But that wasn't surprising. No one ever did. Lemoyne adjusted his bearing. Beneath him, the glaciers and snowfields of the Korowai Ranges were glowing peach and ochre in the late afternoon light, the shadows mauve and violet, the seams and the crevasses midnight blue. He dipped his starboard wing to get a better look, passing over the high peak of Mount Korowai, with its distinctive triple step, like a serrated blade, and then straightened out and radioed for clearance to descend. It wasn't true what he had told her, that he was still learning how to fly. He'd logged over 1,300 flight hours in the past 2 years alone. The running joke at Autonomo, trotted out at every tedious toast and ribbon-cutting function he could remember, was that he didn't trust his company's own product, and that somehow, in all his years designing unmanned aerial systems, he had failed to grasp the meaning of unmanned. The jokes were tiresome, but he could admit the truth they gestured at. Lemoyne loved nothing better than to fly. Nothing in the world compared to the liquid thrill of piloting a craft through three axes of movement, feeling the vertical, the lateral, and the longitudinal as divergent possibilities curving away from him through air that was tactile and elastic and textured with a warp and woof. When in flight, he experienced a double realignment, a shrinking of the universe inside the cockpit that matched the dilation of the universe outside it, so that as the aircraft climbed and the air thinned and the ground fell away and seemed to flatten far beneath him, he began to hear his own breath through his headset and to feel his heartbeat magnify inside his chest. He achieved, at altitude, a profound sense of his own proportion, of the sheer scale of everything he could be, everything he had been, everything he was. And in descent, as now, he always had a holy sense of having pilgrimaged, of returning having seen behind a veil. He was an excellent pilot, and although the airstrip on the Darvish farm did suffer from a crosswind, he'd never had any difficulty coming into land. Lemoyne touched down at the airfield in Kingston and brought the aircraft to a graceful halt. His driver was already waiting, together with his security detail, to convey him back to his hotel. But after he had called in the landing and shut off the engine, he remained seated in the cockpit, smiling to himself, and tapping out a syncopated rhythm on his knee. It was seldom that he got the chance to interact with perfect strangers, and he had forgotten how arousing it could be to gauge his own effect on a genuine blank canvas, someone who had no idea what he was worth. Even more arousing was the fact that she had lied to him, and not in the squirmy, tiresomely self-exculpating way that he was used to whenever one of his factotums let him down, but flagrantly, defiantly, and with the kind of individual flourishes that bespoke a genuine enjoyment of the practice of deception. The camera was an especially nice touch. He might even have fallen for it if he hadn't known already from her data that she was in the habit of assuming false identities. He smiled wider. Mira Bunting, he thought, tasting the syllables. You little criminal. For Lemoyne could recognize his own. He at least had not been trespassing. Jill and Owen Darvish had invited him to make full use of the place in their absence, to stay at the house if he wanted. to keep a car in their garage, to explore, to get a feel for the area, and by all means, please, to make himself at home. But like Mira, he was nursing ambitions for the Darvish farm that went far beyond the crime of trespass. And like Mira, he was highly practiced in concealment. The Darvishes would have been very surprised to learn, for example, that in fact Lemoyne had no need whatsoever to familiarise himself with Thorndyke, since he had been conducting close surveillance of the region for the past 7 years. Not that they would ever find that out. As far as they knew, and as far as they would ever know, Lemoyne was just a billionaire looking for a bolt hole, the kind of man who saw every crisis as an opportunity, and so had begun perusing real estate listings in Thorndyke in the hours directly following the landslide on the pass. He was simply a far-sighted, short-selling, risk-embracing kleptocrat, an incarnation of unapologetic zero-sum self-interest, a radical misfit, a builder in the Randian sense, a genius, a tyrant, an obsessive, a prophet, a status symbol survivalist hedging his bets against any number of potential global catastrophes that he himself was doing absolutely nothing to prevent, and might even be taking active measures to encourage if there was a profit to be made or an advantage to be gained in the pursuit. This was the impression that Lemoyne had taken pains to create, and it was in this guise that he told the Darvishes he was prepared to pay well above the asking price for their property, on the condition of absolute secrecy until the instant that the bunker, he watched their eyes widen, was safely in the ground. He had already purchased a small fleet of diggers and earth movers to carry out the excavation, along with a few RVs and kit-set mobile offices to accommodate the crew. These were waiting in a warehouse at the Littleton port, along with the bunker itself, which had arrived disassembled, the component parts flat-packed into a dozen shipping containers that were ready to be loaded onto trucks and driven south. But the internment of the thing was only pretext. The real work would happen in the clean-up after the bunker was interred. When all these vehicles left Thorndyke, they would not be empty, or filled with slurry, or stacked with broken pallets or packaging or other waste. They would return to the port carrying a cargo worth not just billions, but trillions. A dollar value so enormous that Lemoyne liked to put it in perspective by reminding himself, periodically, that 1 million days had not yet passed since the birth of Jesus Christ. If he pulled this off, and he had never failed in any of his ventures yet, he would become, by several orders of magnitude, the richest person who had ever lived. The plan was so audacious that a part of Lemoyne almost wished he had conceived it right from the start. Inviolate. But the truth was that his presence in New Zealand was an emergency measure, adopted in haste after the landslide had very nearly exposed his entire operation. He had known, of course, that solution mining was extremely hazardous, and that leaching rare earth elements in situ by pumping lixiviant through boreholes drilled directly into the ground risked causing fissures in the bedrock that might precipitate a slip. But he had judged the size of the deposit to be worth the risk, guessing, correctly as it turned out, that Kottawai was close enough to the Alpine Fault that any accidents his men might cause would be taken for ordinary seismic activity. Little quakes and rumblings were a daily occurrence in that part of the world, though most were too faint or too deep to be felt without equipment. What was more, Thorndyke was generally considered to be the back end of Kottawai National Park. The vast majority of visitors entered the park from the southwest corner, nearer to Lake Kawea, where the terrain was more varied and the views more sublime. And even on a good day, the Kottawai Basin rarely saw more than a dozen or so hikers passing through, mostly in pairs or in family groups of three or four. The site was so remote that Lemoyne had assumed, this time incorrectly, that if an accident of some kind were to happen, the fallout would be fairly easily contained. He had been in Miami when the landslide happened, and as he'd logged into the surveillance feed over the pass to see the search and rescue helicopters sweeping overhead and the television vans arriving and the gazebos going up to assist the first responders and the engineers, he had come very close to cashing in his chips entirely. But in all the news coverage of the disaster, nobody had thought to ask, even rhetorically, if the earthquakes might possibly have been man-made. And although the landslide had wiped some of the value off his enterprise, somewhere in the region of $100 million, give or take, the actual damage had been minimal. None of his men on the ground had been spotted, and the extraction site itself remained secure. The real difficulty had come with the closure of the road over the pass. With Thorndike deserted and the barricade in place, a procession of heavy-duty vehicles out of the national park would be sure to attract attention. And the operation was far too sensitive and worth far too much money for Lemoyne to want to wait until the road had been repaired and the viaduct rebuilt before he gave the order to his soldiers to pack out. Playing the survivalist afforded him the perfect cover. The bunker was the perfect Trojan horse. It would have been far safer to have kept his distance, of course, to have used a proxy, and never to have personally entered the country at all. But Lemoyne's risk appetite tended to be whetted by unforeseen disaster. He experienced the deaths of other people as a challenge, a chance for him to test his own mortality and win. There was also a way in which the landslide had played directly into his hands, for he had always intended, once the container ships had left the port with the processed rare earth elements aboard, to detonate the site in Korowai remotely to remove any evidence that anyone had ever been there. And now any explosion he might cause would be even more likely to be taken for an earthquake. No, not just an earthquake, Lemoyne thought, still smiling, still tapping out a rhythm on his knee. Not just an aftershock. An act of God. The soldiers on the ground in Korowai were all Special Forces mercenaries who believed they'd been contracted, through an intermediary organization, by the CIA. They had travelled to New Zealand under a multitude of covers, as IT consultants, scientific researchers, entrepreneurs, and employees of an American military analytics company that was seeking to open a Queenstown office to create a round-the-clock workday, maximizing productivity through all the hours of the American and European night. Their real mission was to capture the payload in the Korowai Basin, leaching the elements on site, and then smuggling them out of the country when the separation process was complete. And their real objective, as they understood it, was to help an alliance of Western nations work in secret to wrest rare earth market dominance away from China by securing a rare earth supply chain, from mine to magnet, for the United States. The mercenaries' understanding was, in other words, about 70% correct. The rare earth market was indeed almost entirely controlled by China, and this stranglehold was indeed of great concern to many Western nations, given the vast number of critical technologies that depended on rare earths, from smartphones to precision-guided weapons to wind turbines, solar panels, and electric cars. New Zealand had indeed explored the possibility of mining its own national parks. Lemoyne had first learned about the Korowai deposit from a report commissioned by the New Zealand government 7 years ago. And the United States was indeed scrambling to establish its own rare earth supply chain to challenge the market dominance of the Chinese. Just that year, a U.S. mining corporation had received Pentagon funding to build two separation facilities in Texas, one of which, if Lemoyne played his cards right, would eventually serve as a laundromat for the Korowai load. But what the mercenaries did not know was that their operation was being carried out without the knowledge of the New Zealand government or the U.S. government. Or either of their militaries, or the government, or the military of any country in the world. Only about a half a dozen people on the planet knew the full extent of what was happening in Korowai National Park. And every one of them answered to Lemoyne.
Yes, he said aloud, as if answering a question from the floor.
Yes, he had caused the earthquakes that had caused the landslide. Yes, five people had been killed already. Yes, their blood was on his hands. But how many died every day in Chinese rare earth mines and processing facilities, many of which used forced labor and child labor and were controlled by criminal syndicates who were themselves murderers and gun runners and human traffickers and worse? How many died downriver from all the toxic and radioactive sludge that these facilities pumped out? How many had died to supply the rare earth components of the plane that he was sitting in, and the phone in his pocket, and the phone in everybody's pocket, and all of everybody's electronics with all their cameras and their GPS capabilities and their LCD displays, and all the navigation systems that had shipped their parts around the world, and all the robotics and computers at all the factories where they were manufactured and assembled and warehoused and packaged and sent out? Five dead was nothing, thought Lemoyne. Five dead, in the scheme of things, was basically no dead at all. Outside, his bodyguards were pacing. They didn't like him flying solo, didn't like his choice of destination, didn't like that he kept going back there, didn't like that he wouldn't tell them why. Partly it just went against their programming. They were ex-Mossad, the top of their game, the best of the best. But the bigger reason, Lemoyne thought, was that they were bored senseless.
They'd been detailing him for almost a decade, all over the globe. And in their years working for him, they'd never had so little to do. They'd begged him to let them charter a second plane to shadow him. And when he refused, they'd begged to drive the long way round, to meet him on the other side of the slip. They'd tried to frighten him with threat levels and danger signs and foiled kidnapping attempts. And they'd come as close as they dared to reminding him of his late wife. But Lemoyne didn't take orders from his own security. He got out his phone and dicked around on Twitter for a few minutes more, just to remind them that their time was his to waste if he wanted to. And then at last he descended from the cockpit and crossed the runway to the waiting SUV.
"The Lodge or the Peak, sir?"
said his driver as he got in.
"The Lodge," he said.
And two of his bodyguards mounted their outriders and peeled off. Lemoyne always checked into at least two luxury hotels at once, and switched between them frequently, often in the middle of the night. All his clothes and luggage were in duplicate, and in each hotel suite he placed a decoy laptop loaded with malicious code, in case anyone got nosy or light-fingered while the room was being cleaned. For the most part, it was just for show. People expected him to be entitled, and he enjoyed cultivating the persona of the paranoid eccentric. It meant that no one ever asked him to explain himself, for one thing, and it always paid to have some handy pretext for throwing his weight around. This was more a tactic than a strategy. He only truly lost his temper very rarely. But in a way, to remain in tactics was the strategy. No one got to where he was in life without some instinct for the madman theory of control. He settled back against the leather headrest and thought again of Mira. It was pure serendipity that they'd encountered one another. Since the Darvishes had left, he'd used the airstrip only a handful of times. Some days staying only for the few minutes that it took to turn the plane around. He kept a car in their garage, as they'd invited him to do. But today was the first he'd ever driven it. And although he had access to the house in case he ever needed to stay over, to date he'd never even put the key in the front door. He had actually been planning to return to California for a week or two, and had messaged his PA that very morning to tell her to start working on his diary. The PA was new, and still needed to be broken in. Perhaps he'd wait a few days, he thought, before informing her there'd been a change of plan. At the lodge, he accessed Mira's browsing history, and saw that after he'd left her, she'd spent the better part of an hour reading up about Autonomo, which had led her, naturally, to the news articles about his wife. She had lingered over these even longer, switching her search to images, typing in Gisella Kazarian, and then clicking back and forth between pictures of the two of them together and pictures of each of them alone. The pictures of the crash itself she barely dwelt on. It was only when she received a warning message saying that she'd reached her monthly data limit that she exited the browser and powered off the device. Lemoyne checked his watch. That was half an hour ago. He could turn her phone on remotely if he wanted, but he considered that an act of last resort. Instead, he connected to the live feed of the drone that was tracking her from overhead and saw that she'd reversed the van a short distance to the water's edge. The rear doors were standing open. She was stooping in the shallows of the lake, her forearms underwater, almost as if she were drowning something. Lemoyne peered at the image, trying to decipher it. Presently, she braced her legs and stood, and he realized that she had been filling a water cooler bottle that she now lugged, with effort, back to the van. She exchanged it for an empty one and returned to the lake to repeat the process. As she submerged the snout of the second vessel, it seemed to occur to her that maybe she was being watched. She craned back her head and looked straight upwards, right into the lens. And for a thrilling moment, Lemoyne felt that they were seeing eye to eye. But the light was fading, and the drone must have been too high to make out. For in the next moment, she dropped her gaze to scan the ranges, and then the treetops, and then around the pebbled lakeshore, seeming only thoughtful, and not in the least suspicious or afraid. The bottle was full. She set it on its end and screwed on the cap, then hoisted it bodily out of the water. Minutes later, she was shutting the van's rear doors, climbing into the driver's seat, and turning back onto the highway. Lemoyne kept his laptop open while he shaved and showered, and when he returned from the bathroom, naked and toweling himself, the drone had switched to night vision. He could no longer see the van, but the camera was hanging steadily over the roof of the shearing shed, suggesting that Mira had driven the vehicle inside. The image showed no further movement as he dressed. And so after he had brushed his teeth and spritzed his hair with texturizer, he disconnected from the feed, locked the laptop and the safe that contained all his live devices, and called his driver to take him to the restaurant, where his guests, an obnoxious right-wing talk show host and his brash producer wife, were already waiting. One of the many things that a career in covert monitoring had taught Lemoyne was that in most circumstances nothing attracted more attention than somebody attempting to blend in. A far better form of camouflage was to choose a costume that conformed to some blatant stereotype and then to wear it openly, deliberately courting judgment and inviting bias, until general opinion had been fixed. After that, one could virtually do as one pleased, for while people were quick to form opinions, they were just as slow to change them. And, to rephrase the aphorism slightly, there were none so blind as those who had already decided what it was they saw. Mira had plainly understood this, at least as far as her own deceptions were concerned. Whether she would fall for his was another question. But she had crumbled under pressure. She had allowed herself to be frightened, and she had given everything away. That was something Lemoyne would never do. He was smiling again as the car arrived at the restaurant, and he stepped out. But he wiped his expression clean before he entered the building, for his own chosen costume that evening was to be Lemoyne the Libertarian, Lemoyne the Misanthrope, Lemoyne the doomsday-prepping, New Zealand citizenship-seeking, investment-opportunity-dangling billionaire. He was 45 minutes late, a power play so standard in his circle that he had sometimes wondered if actually the more disconcerting move would be to arrive on time, or even early. And his guests were visibly relieved to see him. They exchanged pleasantries, agreed the weather was just marvelous, and sat down. Lemoyne had been a teetotaler all his life, and if there was one expression he could recognize in any circumstance, it was the look of panicked disappointment worn by a certain kind of social alcoholic when he declined a drink. He caught it now on the faces of his dinner companions as he waved away the wine list and ordered soda water with a twist, and knew at once that he was going to find a way to cut the dinner short, before the main course, if necessary.
"But don't let me stop you," he said politely. "Please."
They looked even more panicked.
"No, no, no," said the talk show host, very loudly. "We'll join you. It's good to take a night off."
He inclined his head beseechingly towards Lemoyne, as if expecting the billionaire to thank him.
"We'll have the same," he said to the waiter, when Lemoyne said nothing. "Two more of those. Yeah, mate, thanks."
"Are you sober, Robert? Or just taking a break?" said the wife when the waiter had departed, and Lemoyne covered his annoyance by giving his standard response to inopportunate questions.
"Yes," he said, not specifying. "Ever since my wife died."
This was true, but misleading. He watched her blush.
"I'm so sorry," she said. "Of course."
"Nah, but good on you, though,"
said her husband, coming to her aid.
"So many benefits to it, aren't there? I always think I'd get so much more out of the day if I cut back."
The wife was nodding.
"And I bet you sleep so well," she said.
"Like a baby," said Lemoyne, flashing her his best, most roguish smile.
She looked startled, but the talk show host laughed and sat back in his seat with a new confidence, as if the first hurdle of the evening had been cleared.
"Whereabouts are you staying, Robert?" he said.
"The Peak," said Lemoyne.
"Oh, very nice," said the wife.
"I hope they're showing you a bit of Kiwi hospitality."
Lemoyne decided to fuck with him.
"What's that?"
he said.
"I mean, I hope they're taking care of you."
"But what would make it Kiwi, specifically?"
The man looked a little flummoxed.
"Just really friendly, I guess,"
he appealed to his wife.
"And informal," she said. "Down to earth."
"Good food," he said. "Good coffee. We're very snobby about our coffee here."
"Flat whites," said the wife.
"It's the one thing,"
said the talk show host, holding up one finger.
"It's the one thing we're really snobby about."
They were visiting from Auckland. It would be an understatement to say that Lemoyne was not typically in the habit of fraternizing with the locals. But political alignment was part of his disguise, and he had learned, within minutes of making their acquaintance at the golf club, that the talk show host had recently been suspended from the air, following some violation of broadcast standards, and that the wife had resigned in solidarity as his producer. Following a very public row about offence and overreach,
Lemoyne hadn't cared enough to be able to recall the details. They had decided to turn the period of enforced time off into a holiday, and they had the defiant, mildly aggressive air of two people now determined to enjoy themselves at any cost. They had told him, standing on the seventh green, that they had begun incubating an idea to establish a right-wing media platform in New Zealand, of the kind that was enjoying such runaway success elsewhere. And before Lemoyne had time to comment, they'd added, without even an attempt at subtlety, that, in actual fact, they were on the hunt for an investor. This was not at all Lemoyne's usual mode of doing business, but he had his disguise to think about, and as a libertarian survivalist, he could hardly find anyone more sympathetic to his existence than a nihilistic shock jock with a fragile ego and an axe to grind. What the hell, he'd thought, and had suggested that they get to know each other better over dinner, causing such undisguised avarice and triumph that he'd almost retracted the invitation on the spot.
"Yes, I had a flat white," he said now, lying. "It was good."
They looked pleased.
"So we're treating you okay then," said the man. "Well, we must be, if you're looking to stay on." "You're certainly doing something right," said Lemoyne.
"Best little country in the world," said the woman.
"Most of us," said the man. "Most of the time."
"The God Zone," said the woman. "Have you come across that at all?"
"No," said Lemoyne.
"It's from God's own country, God's own. But it's like the God Zone."
"It's how you feel when you're down here," the man explained. "You're in the God Zone." "Not a bad brand," said Lemoyne. "I think it's taken," said the man. "But you're not wrong, actually."
"I see the way you think," said the wife teasingly. "Always thinking."
And this time they both laughed. Lemoyne suppressed an urge to get up from the table and walk out.
"So give me a sense of the media landscape here," he said. "Where do you see it all moving? What's changing? What's not changing? What are the flashpoints? Where are the gaps?"
But as they began to answer, his mind flitted back to Mira, and he saw again the fearful challenge in the way she'd looked at him. He saw her calculation in summoning her courage and in making her escape. He saw her fascination. He saw her desire. He heard the reedy wobble in her voice that had betrayed her apprehension when she'd asked him how he'd known her name. As he conjured her deliciously inside himself, he realized, all at once, that she would be his acquisition. She would be his venture. She would be the final piece of camouflage. Not these dime a dozen grasping, self-important outrage mongers, these obsequious non-entities, these small-time pseudo-pundits who traded in stupidity and called themselves subversive for shitting where they ate. Everyone expected him to move into the media. Well, he was going to do what nobody expected. He was going to put his money into Burnham Wood. He heard his name and blinked. They were staring at him.
"What?"
he said. There was a little pause. Then the woman said, in a strange, frightened voice,
"You were laughing."